The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, let's take a quick look at what we want to accomplish in our class today. And first of all, is to just cover briefly the requirements, overview of some of the main documents that we'll be considering. So number one, I'm going to ask you to write a 25-plus page paper. You know, again, it doesn't have to be only 25. If you feel like you have more to say, that's fine. But that gives you a kind of a minimal threshold. You'll have a lot of room to discuss and pursue an idea in that dimension. And a topic that I will approve. I want to give you as much freedom as I can, but I want to make sure it's within the boundaries of what this course is intended to focus upon. Okay. Secondly, you're going to do a project of some kind in this class, and I'll give you some ideas of what that project is. For example, A, compare the Westminster Confession of Faith. See, some of you love the confession so much, I'm giving you a chance to bring it in indirectly, okay? Compare the confession or the Augsburg Confession, which is the foundational Protestant confession, okay? It's what starts off the whole Protestant confessional movement, really. It's the Lutheran theology in its first early form, and it's really what the Protestants everywhere believed as the Reformation began. One of those two documents with a selected Reformed confession, that's a project you can do. And by comparison, it means I want you to get into the details where you sit down and say, all right, what do they say about justification here? What do they say in this one? How's it alike? How's it different? Okay. And you might say, well, which do I have before me? Well, I list at least 12 that you could consider. And obviously some of these are more able to be compared in other ways, but it opens up all the vistas of comparison down to the details as far as you can go, as narrowly or broadly as you construe it. That's fine. Secondly, another possibility for a project is to consider some of the untranslated confessions that still exist. If you have some Latin or German skills, or maybe some French, there are actually some, as far as I know, now maybe I'm wrong, I notice I say if there are any after investigation, as far as I can tell, there are still some that no one's ever bothered to publish. Now, that makes an exciting opportunity. You say, well, for the first time, we can get an ancient reformational creed back into the public discourse. That's a work for historical, because a lot of people don't have linguistic skills, but yet need to know more about these things. So I could be proven wrong, but at least in my preliminary investigation, I've not been able to find English translations of the First Helvetic Confession, the Tetrapolitan Confession. Now, the First Helvetic would have been one that would have been produced by the Zurich theologians, including Bullinger and some others that were close to him. The Tetrapolitan Confession was one that would have been done by Martin Bucer, who for the four cities that were not able to sign on with the Augsburg Confession. There's Zwingli's Ratio Fidei. That was what he produced in 1530. Now, again, they may be an English translation. I've just failed, That's why I'm leaving myself some elbow room, because I don't remember seeing these in English as I've investigated and again as I've looked recently. I think there also is a document called the Strasbourg Confession that Bucer wrote up for the city of Strasbourg that is distinguishable from the Tetrapolitan. I may be mistaken on that, but again, that's one of those loose ends that I, in my reading over the past years, the angles out there. And as far as I know, the Sorbonne Articles, which were a Roman Catholic confession that challenged very early on the Reformation, has never been put into English. So if you're a Latinist, that might be an exciting thing to produce. Now, before you go to doing that work, do the scholarly research and don't let me lead you down a rabbit trail and say, why did I translate something that someone did 50 years ago and it's just kind of lost to the... I mean, do a good research before you take a project like that. But that, I think, would give you a challenge to do a project that would actually be very significant in a narrow sense. I mean, it's not that the world's clamoring for it, but it will for those in the future who do confessional studies, you'll make available a good tool. Okay, so that's a project that's available. So you have your choice of A or B as one of your projects. Everybody will do C as well, okay? So you can choose A or B, but and also a second and a lesser a weighty project, but one that I want you to do is to share with the class a two-page summary of an article or book on an aspect of Reformed Confessions of the Reformation. Again, I want to be able to approve that before you do it. So get down there in the shelves or take the wonderful computerized system now and plug in the words Continental Confessions or Reformed Confessions and see what you come up with. I've already done that. There's a lot of stuff. And there may be a direction you might want to go that will be interesting. But the idea is to summarize and critique that in just a couple pages so that we all can expand our reading horizons a little bit and you'll give us something to put in our files. Okay. Now, when you do your paper, back to number one, I would like to propose that you, again, out of your research, give us maybe a 10 to 15 page segment of something that you think is valuable that you'd like to put in everybody's file that you find very strategic. In your research, you'll certainly come across an article or a piece of original material and say, this is excellent. I'm really glad I found this. I don't think anybody even knows about this, and they ought to. Well, when those kind of bells go on, copy it off, and that's part of your class presentation. You will be presenting that paper and a schedule that we'll set up probably next class or the following, where we'll pass around just a schedule. And since we're a smaller class with only four here, there'll be lots of time to present. Now, if you're an auditor and don't want to present, we won't force you to do it. But if you'd like to be that serious, it's small enough that I can give our auditors plenty of room to be serious with their work. Okay? All right. Now let's take a look at something else here. Let me unstack some pages. For our next class, I'd like to ask you to begin by reading an article that I wrote a couple years ago. It's in the volume called The Practice of Confessional Subscription. And I have an article here called Confessional Subscription Among the 16th Century Reformers. And I'd like you to all read that. And we'll kind of interact with that as part of our background for our time together. Now, are any of you going to be in my Lutheran Orthodoxy class? You will be there?
I'm thinking
of it. Okay. They're different, but so it won't hurt you that may be in that class. I'd like you for next time to read three things. One is to read through the Augsburg Confession, which is the great Lutheran confession that starts the Reformation that all the Reformers read. You can find that in many sources. The one that I've, in the Lutheran class, Lutheran Orthodoxy class, I've asked the class to buy the Book of Concord. That's the classic book of confessions of the Lutheran tradition. You'll find that in there, and you can read it. You'll also find it in Schaff's Creeds of Christendom. It'll be in volume 3. It's the first one, if I remember, in that volume. Okay, so you're welcome to read it in Latin, German, and or English. Okay? All right? So they're available for you there. Now, and the other things I'd like you to read are the 67 articles of Zwingli. I think, let me double check, I think those are, I don't know that they have been translated fully. In Schaff, they are presented in German and Latin. So if you have a linguistic ability, trying to agonize through them, either language or both, as you can. And if you can't do that, I think there is a beginning of a translation of them, at least partially, in the book by Hillerbrand called The Reformation, a narrative history related by contemporary observers and participants. And I'll try to find the pages here on that. I think at least part of them are available. I think you'll find that, I believe, on pages 132 and 33. Yeah, pretty sure that's right. Okay, and that will at least give you a little English flavor. Part of them are translated here. I don't know that they've ever fully been translated. That would be, and if they aren't, that could be a nice project for someone for the class. Okay, so what we'll do next time is we want to consider the Augsburg Confession, the 67 Articles of Zwingli, and the 10 Theses of Berne, which is the number 2 on your outline here, which is a very simple statement of some of the early Reformational theology. Again, you might say, where can I find that? Well, if this book by Leith, Creeds of the Church, has the 10 Theses of Berne translated. And I don't remember now, again, if we have it here in Schaff. Let me double check. That, again, there it's in the German and Latin form. Leith has it in English, okay? So simply translated. So that's where you can find it there. So for our discussion for next time, what I'd like us to do is to get a flavor of some of the early Protestant creeds that were on the continent. That's where the Reformation was really taking its initial form. And to read the article that I've written, which is designed to talk about how the creeds all the way across the board came into being. In that article, you'll find I'm focusing on what was required by the people under the oversight of the confession. What subscription formula did they have to take? And it's a very fascinating study of the power and force of how confessions were used. At the end of the article, I'll present really a kind of a paradigm of uses of confessions. If you take a look at page 59 in this article, you notice I give what I call an early, middle, and mature stage of confessional development, where it has different purposes at different stages of the use of a confession. Early on, it is an opportunity to confess one's faith and to defend it and to develop brotherly relationships, ecumenicity, and to be teaching. And then as it goes along, it will begin to develop another force of uniformity, getting everybody to be alike, establishing orthodoxy, seeing if you can qualify for office, and helping to define critical theological issues that are being contested. And then finally, in its mature and most confrontational form, it will become a polemical tool, where it will be used to bludgeon people into obedience. And it's designed to restrict people, to keep them away, and to force a person's confession of a faith that may not be naturally his. So there's different levels in which confessions can be used. And so the idea of a confession, and we'll see all that as you read through examples of it. So I encourage you to read that. So our goal for next time is to really have a free-ranging discussion. Okay, I'll have some lecture focal points, but I hope we'll come prepared to talk about why a confession, why did it come up in the Reformation, why did the Augsburg Confession develop, what were the issues, and then some of the early Reformed confessions as well. You'll notice that the 67 Articles of Zwingli are 7 years before the Augsburg Confession. So in a certain sense, it's fascinating that Zwingli was confessing, in a sort of way, his faith right from the beginning, and that in Bern, the Reformed tradition was trying to lay down some documents. And 1530, the great classic statement of other Lutheran ideas come to force under Melanchthon's hand, representing Luther's theology. Okay, so we'll look at that in discussion and along with that article. So that's where we want to go next time. Okay, now I have one other page that in my stack of things here that I want to share. I had tried to put together a chart of the various confessions as to how they work out. Now, maybe some of you have seen this before because I prepared it for another class along the way. As we try to get an idea of the confessional families that are in front of us as we look at creeds and confessions, the first thing that we want to see is that really confessional history in its formal declaration begins in 1530 when Charles V calls together the disputants of the Protestant-Catholic debate to state their views, especially that the Protestants' views will be heard. And so in 1530, the classic Protestant statement will be given. And everything is really explained in light of that document. It carries the primary weight out of which all the other confessions will ultimately emerge in the Protestant and Catholic variety. And so what we see first of all is that Melanchthon develops this confession. It will come into being, and it will spawn immediately other confessions. Okay, this is a great confessional age. People are writing down what they believe, what you must believe, and to establish orthodoxy and heterodoxy. And so immediately there is a confutation written in 1530. That's a Roman Catholic criticism. If you take the left sign and side, you go all the way down, you see the Roman Catholic at the bottom. So that's the Catholic side. And that is in English. That was one of the confessions I thought had not been translated. And a student a couple years ago did some research and said, yes, it is. So it is available out there if you want to pursue that as one of your topics of comparing a confession, for example. It might be fascinating to do comparison of the Confutation, the Augsburg Confession. That would be a possibility. It'll give you a Roman Catholic flavor versus the Protestant flavor. Okay. another thing that happens in the middle and right side is that you see you have the development in 1530 of what's called the Tetrapolitan Confession. And that's what we mentioned earlier is the Confession of Bucer, where Bucer is not able to submit to Luther's theology of the Supper. And so he's compelled to write his own confession. Now, it just so happens that Charles will not receive any other. He says, I want one voice for the Protestants. So they came with others, but they were not received. But nevertheless, they were prepared. So Bucer presents his own. And it is important to recognize that there are other issues already surfacing that show distinctive theological qualities even in these early years. Okay? So we have the Tetrapolitan Confession that is spawned by the Augsburg Assembly, the Diet of Augsburg. And then on the right-hand side, you're going to have Zwingli's Ratio Fidei, 1530, which will be his contribution that he was bringing to represent the Swiss theology. Now, the reason that it's in Zwingli's name is that by the time it was composed, it did not have time to make it to the magistrates for review and to have an official imprimatur of Zurich or any other. And so it's just given in his own name, but it is not received formally. But it is an attempt to present a theology at the bequest of Charles V at this early reformational stage. So we have then three streams that begin to emerge immediately. You have the Roman Catholic Confutation, the kind of Lutheran Reformed position of Bucer, and then the distinctively Reformed, almost non-Lutheran approach of Zwingli. And that begins to offer some strains that will develop. Now, for our purposes, it's important to note that there is a strand that we will not pursue at all in this class, and that's the one that you can look at the bottom right next to the Roman Catholic, which we call the Anglican. Okay, that's by definition non-continental. That's more of the English side of the Reformation, English-Scottish Reformation. And what will happen here is that when the 42 articles of 1553 are drawn up, they are very consciously an attempt to develop the theology of the Augsburg Confession in an English setting. That there was a clear use by Cranmer and others to borrow the theology of Melanchthon and Luther to craft the English Reformation. So there is a direct link, and there are works that have been done by Anglican scholars on the 39 articles and who pointed out that there is a direct link to the Augsburg Confession. There are several years that passed between them, but there was a very conscious use of the Lutheran theology. Now that will be redacted in 1563 to the 39 articles, and it will establish the traditional Anglican theology. Now if you go from the 39 articles, you see some bylines that will take, some are represented at Dort from the Anglican Communion, and of course there's a very direct impact on the Westminster Confession through the 39 articles. Okay, now you come back to the middle stream, and one of the things that you need to see here is that as a direct result of Augsburg and the Confutation, in 1531 we have what's called the Apology. Okay, the Apology is Melanchthon's refutation of the Confutation. Okay, so you see there's the Augsburg Confession, then the Roman Catholic Confutation, and then there's Melanchthon's Apology, where he's giving a defense of the Confession in light of the criticisms that come from the Roman Catholic Confutation. You might say, where in the world can you find that? Well, Melanchthon's Apology becomes part of the creedal theology of Lutheranism. It is found in the Book of Concord. So if you happen to have Tappert, you'll find that there is a fairly lengthy defense of the theology of the Augsburg Confession written by Melanchthon, which is called the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. So you can see that's here. And that is a lengthy writing and a very important one. Okay? Now, what will happen is that in the aftermath of this, the cities from the Tetrapolitan tradition are going to actually give up their confession so that they can join in with the Lutherans in the Schmalkald League. Remember, there was the struggle as the battles were raging between Lutheran and Catholic in Germany, that the cities that were there said, we belong in the Schmalkald League for defense. We're basically Protestants. So forget having our own distinct confession. Let's merge in. And so The Tetrapolitan Confession will kind of give way and yield to the small called League, although it is interesting that when Martin Bucer dies, on his deathbed, he confesses his faith and says it is the faith of the Tetrapolitan Confession. So he holds that confession as his own until his deathbed. Okay, Bucer doesn't give it up, even though the city formally says, let's move more in the direction of staying within the sphere of the Augsburg Confession and Apology as it's being kind of fashioned with the small Caldic League. Okay, now, I don't think, as I remember now, that the, they are here in 1537, the Schmalkaldic Articles will actually be added as the fourth document of the Book of Concord. So they take on an authority in Lutheran theology.
So is the is that basically Lutheran?
It is basically Lutheran through and through. Okay.
So its view of, the key issue is its view of the Lord's Supper.
Yeah, well, as far as I can tell, the Schmalkaldic Articles do not in any way shape or change the view of Luther's theology of the Supper. That really comes up in this next debate about the Invariata and the Variata, okay, which is on our outline that follows next. But what you see is there this kind of Lutheran Reformed mix in Bucer, who's really working hard to bring along a compromise. He's kind of like the Henry Kissinger of the Reformation, doing shuttle diplomacy, going back and forth, trying to bring the parties together to say, can't we agree? And he's never quite successful in that, but he labors all his life to accomplish that. All right, now, to go back to the right side so we can kind of keep them in parallel in time, Zwingli's Ratio Fidei will finally be given a further development, and it will become an official Swiss statement. Remember, it was given only in his name. Zwingli will die very quickly after the Augsburg died at Augsburg on the battlefield of Kapelle, and his successors, including Henry Bullinger, will put together the first Helvetic Confession of 1534. And as I say, to my knowledge, I am not certain that either one of those are in print in English, although that may well be available, and I just have not come across them. So I ask you, if you're interested in the project, they might be available for particular investigation. But what happens is that out of that mix of this first Helvetic Confession, the Swiss theology, and the earlier Augsburg Confession, there's going to become the conversion of a fellow by the name of John Calvin. Okay, Calvin is going to sign the Augsburg Confession. Eventually he will, but he's coming out of it from the Swiss French Reformed tradition. And so what will eventually happen is that he will sign the confession finally in its Variata form of 1540. Okay? That is the confession that ultimately Calvin will take as his own, and under that he is going to develop the famous Genevan Catechism. Okay? Which is really under the aegis of the Augsburg Confession, but also very consciously being influenced to a certain extent by Bullinger, Zwingli, and theology. So he's kind of in the middle here. So he's yet another variation between Bucer and Zwingli. You know, he's kind of in the middle there. And what happens now in 1540, just to keep the confessional traditional and clear in your mind, is that there has been a relationship that's been struck up between Melanchthon and Calvin. Melanchthon is the author of the Augsburg Confession that starts the whole thing. Okay, he's the understudy of Luther. But they discover a kindred spirit in terms of their humanistic knowledge and approach to Scripture. That is, they both have a very keen love for the original languages and high scholarship. And so very early on, they discover each other and strike up a friendship. And in the process, Melanchthon begins to be influenced by Calvin's view of the Supper. And he develops what becomes known as crypto-Calvinism. That is, a secret Calvinism under Lutheran dress. Now, it just so happens that Melanchthon will make other moves. Melanchthon will begin to say, I'm uncomfortable with this really strong Augustinian predestinarianism that we find in Luther's Bondage of the Will. And he will begin to develop a very modest, synergistic theology, not one that throws up an Arminian, we can do everything we want with free will, but one that gives room to the human will, one that begins to lessen the absolute predestinarianism that seems, as far as I can tell, to be really present in Luther's theology, at least in the Bondage of the Will. In fact, I can honestly say, when I was at Dallas Seminary many years ago, I was reading The Bondage of the Will when I became a thoroughly committed Calvinist. I said, that's what that's talking. If Luther believed it, not just Calvin, it's got to be reformational theology. Well, subsequently, I had the opportunity when I was at the program here at Westminster to study at the Lutheran Seminary not far from here, and Dr. Helmut Lehmann, who is one of the key editors of the English translation of Luther's works, was, I don't know if he's still teaching there now, but he was there. And I remember being in a class called Comparative Confessions with him. And I made that point, said, oh, no, you're misreading Luther. Luther never meant any of that stuff. And I said, oh, come on, he meant that. You guys have just followed Melanchthon is what's happened. You know, you're following the downgrading of his theology. But be that as it may, Melanchthon is a changing person. He is willing to move. And so on one hand, he softens predestinarianism. And I think he's basically followed by Lutherans. Melanchthonianism in terms of a synergistic, a very modest synergism, and yet that theology will become, I think, codified ultimately, and down here at the Formula of Concord in 1580, Melanchthon's impression will be followed. In terms of the view of the Lord's Supper, which is what we want to talk about in terms of the variata and invariata, basically what happens is that Melanchthon says, I think Calvin is right, that you must be a believer to partake of the body and blood of Christ in the supper. It is not an automatic thing because of some consubstantiation theology. Melanchthon moves into what we could call a receptionism or a Calvinistic view of a spiritual presence. And so he's no longer strictly a consubstantiation thinker a la Luther. And so what does he do? He changes the language of the Augsburg Confession. And after all, he says, why can't I edit? I wrote it. But the problem is that it's no longer a private document. It's also a public document because it was given authority in 1530 by the whole discussion with the Charles V. The emperor had given it an official status as the theology of Protestantism. So here now there's a conflicting interest. You know, it doesn't have any paragraph. These may be amended by the following process. So who gets to change, the author or the tradition or the emperor? Well, simply the language is changed in such a way that it no longer forces a person to have a consubstantiation theology. That means then that if you can believe that there is a real presence of Christ somehow in the supper, well then in the variata you stand comfortably. Because that's all that Melanchthon's language forces you to say. It no longer forces you to say that there is a true physical presence of the body and blood of Christ in with and under, as the original Lutheran theology says. Okay? Now, I'm saying a lot of stuff fast, assuming that you have enough handle on the Reformation that I don't have to unpack all that. Okay? If you have questions, stop me.
Can you explain the difference between invariata and variata?
That's what I'm doing right now, and this is the bottom line.
That's what I thought.
Okay. And so basically what it is, then, is that the invariata is the original Augsburg Confession. It's the unvaried form. The variata means changed. It's varied. Okay, it is a different form. The difference, I think, was in Article 10, if I'm remembering correctly now, where the language of requiring the in with and under of Luther is not there. So you see, in Lutheran theology, there was the idea of the communicatio of the attributes of Christ's physical presence, so that somehow in the supper there is an omnipresence of Christ's flesh. Remember the ubiquity of the body? That was under the theology of consubstantiation, so that there is not a change of the elements, but an adding to them. And so that even when an unbeliever would partake, he would eat the body and blood of Christ under his judgment. Okay? In Calvin's theology, none of that is true. Calvin says, no, there is no leaving of Christ's glorified flesh from heaven by the ubiquity of the body of Christ. There is no communicatio idiomatorum, that is the communication of the attributes of the physical and the divine to the physical in the two natures of Christ in the hypostatic union. Nor is there, therefore, a partaking of the unbeliever. There's only the believer who partakes, and he does so through the power of the Holy Spirit. His view, called spiritual presence or virtualism or receptionism. Okay, and so that is what the variata, the changed language of the Augsburg Confession, allowed. A Calvinistic view of the supper but still under the traditional Lutheran formula. Now, why is that important? Well, suddenly, it opens up the very astute political possibility of being in the Zwinglian Reform tradition and yet having the political protections of the Augsburg Confession. Because you see, eventually, in certain areas, the Augsburg Confession is going to be given blessings and protections and freedoms. And if you were Reformed, you couldn't stand under it if you read it in the Inveriata form, because you'd have to be a Lutheran. But once Melanchthon had changed it, it gave elbow room, and Reformed people could find themselves comfortably under the umbrella of the Augsburg Confession and thereby get the political freedoms to practice their theology and their worship. And so it was very interesting and strategic. But what that ended up doing is it created a dual tradition under Lutheranism. Okay? It ended up meaning you could say, I have Augsburg Confession commitments even though I'm not a Lutheran. Now that was a problem for Lutherans. They said, how dare you be a Zwinglian type person and be under the Lutheran Confession? Because Zwingli had never been under it. Further, it was a problem for the Zurichers in the early years because they said, we've never been under the Augsburg Confession. We don't want to be under it. But that's exactly the issue that will come about when you come down here to the Consensus Tigurinus of 1549, published in 1554, under the Zwinglian side. What happens is that there is now going to be a merger in Switzerland between the German-speaking and French-speaking Reformations, and they come together under Calvin's theology. Bullinger and Calvin strike up an agreement, and they do so directly under, if you will, the aegis of the Variata of the Augsburg in Calvin's case. That's why you see the line connecting them there, okay, that there's a direct flow. All right, now the Helvetic tradition had never been under this, but in the language, they actually appeal to the Augsburg Confession. And Calvin persuades them to do so because he says there is a great blessing and wisdom to be able to be under this. Okay, now, so the Genevan Catechism then becomes a very important version and of the early Swiss French version of the theology of Zwingli as it modulated through Bullinger and Calvin. Now, if you're interested in the Genevan Catechism, you say, well, where in the world do I find that? Okay, well, let's see if I can put my hand on it here. I don't know. Did I leave it in the car? Maybe I left one of my volumes behind. But you can find the Genevan Catechism in the Library of Christian Classics. It'll have the translation of that, and so you can look there. And I don't know what I did with my copy. I had intended to bring it. Let me see if Leith has it too. No, he does not have it here. Now, Leith will have the Augsburg Confession if you're in English translation as well. He also has the Ten Conclusions of Bern, but he does not have Calvin's translation. There is, a little translation of it in our library independently in English. I've seen it there. And if you're interested in looking at it in the original French or Latin, it's in the Calvini Opera series, that big Corpus Reformatorum subsection of all of Calvin's works, that the big fat brown volumes there at the end of the BX section. And you can look at it there. But that is available in English, and you can find it in the volume called The Early Writings of Calvin in the Library of Christian Classics series. Okay, and that's where you can find the Genevan Catechism. All right, where will you find the Inveriata and Variata? I think you'll find that a Tappert, I think, reflects both of those in the Lutheran version. Now, where do you find the Consensus Tigurinus? You can find an English translation of that available in the Outlines of Theology by Hodge. A.A. Hodge has at the back of it, at the very end, two appendices. It's called the Consensus Tigurinus, or the Formula Consensus Helvetica. It's an English translation. And I think this volume is still in print. I mean, it's kind of never goes out of print. It's a classic Christian Presbyterian training manual. And you can find that at the back of this. I think it's also available in another form in English translation.
think the bookstore has.
Do they have?
I think they have copies.
Okay, so you can. So I do know it's readily available, and that's one source of an English translation for this.
And why did Hodge include that?
I think at that time he included it because it was an important confessional document that was not readily available, and he wanted to make it because it does, obviously there was a great debate going on at the time of his father with Nevin from Mercersburg, and there was a huge debate over what was the true Calvinistic and Presbyterian theology of the Supper. And the Mercersburg theology had a very high view of the Supper and a spiritual presence. And Hodge was a very strong Zwinglian, and they clashed and wrote a lot. And so I think there was a reason to make that debate more readily available in a simple form for the beginning theological students. And the argument that I think Hodge could make is, well, look at Zwingli's theology and Calvin's came together in a real compromise here. So we can't interpret it as though it's such a high Calvinism that it's... that it loses sight of the Zwinglian side. And I think the fact that the compromise was reached was a way of trying to healing the debate of sorts. I don't know for sure, but that would be part of my guess, okay, that this was a way of saying, look, the two parties came together long ago. Can't we kind of have a common ground on the same document? Okay, that's my guess. All right, now I know there's other forms of this available, and I don't... Oh, here's the Calvin volume. I'm sorry, I overlooked it. This is the one I was looking for. Calvin's Theological Treatises, the Genevan Catechism is represented in this work. Okay, Library Christian Classic Series, the Theological Treatises. I said it was his early works, but this is the volume where you find it. Okay, another place where you can find that, the Consensus Tigurinus and Genevan Catechism, will be in Volume 2 of Calvin's selected works called Tracts. There's the seven-volume series of Calvin's works where all of his letters are translated and several of his treatises. Okay, and this was done by the Calvin Theological Society, and this is back in print, I think, by Baker. Now, I don't know if it's in print again now, but it's in this particular volume, you will find, again, a Genevan Catechism and an English translation of the Consensus Tigurinus. Okay? So that's where you'll get some of the theology in English form. Okay, all these books I'll leave for you to look at later on the table here. Okay, and I've discussed all those. All right, now let's continue on, just to kind of keep the flow chart in front of us and where you can find this material. An aspect of our discussion that we need to introduce right into the middle that is not reflected in our chart is some other theology that develops along the way in Calvin's era. If you look at the handout that I've given to you, I think we've mentioned the Catechism of Geneva, the Consensus Tigurinus. Then there comes along what's called the Second Helvetic Confession. That will complete basically the Reformed tradition side before you get to the... Again, is a product of Henry Bullinger. Bullinger is the great creedal writer of the maturing of the Swiss-German Reformation. He will have a hand in the First Helvetic Confession, the Consensus Tigurinus, and he will be the unique author of the Second Helvetic Confession. Okay, the Second Helvetic Confession is probably the most ecumenical of all the Reformed confessions. It has been adopted as a secondary or tertiary standard by more Reformed churches worldwide than any other.
This is the second.
That's the Second Helvetic Confession. Okay. Apparently, Bullinger wrote this when he was very ill as a theological testimony to his own faith, thinking that he was going to die, and the Lord granted him further years of life. And one of the reasons that I particularly love this confession is because of its remarkably tender and pastoral character. For those of you that have a ministry side to your scholarship, you will delight in Bullinger. If you want to be more academically rigorous, you'll say, well, this is maybe not as precise or tough as you want. But it has something of the character of what the Heidelberg Catechism has been famous for, which is that caring for a person's heart as well as their mind in creating the theology. And Bullinger must have been a remarkable pastoral theologian because there's a special breathing of the love of the Lord in the church that comes out of the Second Helvetic Confession. Now you might say, where do you find that? Well, that is available in the very end of volume, not the very end, but close to the end of volume 3 of Schaff, an English translation. It's an appendix that comes up in volume 3 at about page 31, I guess. It's fully translated, and it's again, well worth studying. And I would recommend, if you're ever teaching Reformed theology on a popular level, you ought to have this handy. You'll find it to be very, very helpful. Good use of Scripture. Page 30, volume 3 of Schaff's Creeds of Christendom. Page 31 of the appendix. Excuse me, I'm sorry. They're missing a page. It's 831. Okay. It says 32 here. This is unpaginated. And then I looked, 833. So they left off a number there. It's page 831 is where it begins of volume 3. Okay. All right. Now, what happens next as we continue to just basically look at the right side of our outline and look at all of these lines that begin to go off, as you begin to realize is that the Reformed tradition is incredibly a confessing tradition, that they are not satisfied to say we've said it once or that another country has said it. They want to put together their own version, and each of the countries where the Reformed tradition begins to be known, it is going to craft a tradition of its own confession or catechism or both. Okay? So what we see next now is that out of the Genevan tradition and the Swiss tradition, we find the merging together of the Consensus Tigurinus. And shortly thereafter, we will find the beginning of a national confession that will begin to flow into the Calvinistic side of theology. Okay, and here in 1559, we have what will be called the Gallican Confession of Faith, or as the French will call it, the Confession of La Rochelle. This is very consciously Calvin's theology, mediated through a student, I think, by the name of Deschandu, and it's signed at a very high-level meeting of the royal family with Beza at the free city of La Rochelle on the far west coast of France, where you are right on the edge of the sea. Okay, a free city, you'll remember, was a city-state. It was not directly under the crown. I had the privilege of visiting La Rochelle just at the fall of last year. It's a fascinating place. It's a city that actually was surrounded by Richelieu and starved to death to destroy their Huguenot witness. They survived several assaults and battles. And it was a place where I think at one point 80% of the city had become a Protestant Huguenot in faith. And so it was a very important place where the theology emanated of Calvin through the rest of France. Beza describing it says it's certainly a sign of God's wonderful providence that a place that was once the haunt of pirates and all sorts of despicable characters, because after all, a free city was outside the rule of the king, and you kind of run these islands on the coast, that it became the place of the great reforming theology that changed a nation. Okay, so it's kind of so that's like the Lord, to take the lowest of the low and use it as the place to bring great grace. But maybe when we get to that confession, I'll tell you more about some of the fun things I discovered being at La Rochelle. I was very amazed at being in that place and visiting the museums and things that were there. Well, let me put it this way. The Edict of Nantes established almost a whole century of the free exercise of the Reformed religion. But after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes that occurred, I can't remember the exact date, late 1600s, early 1700s, back in that era, there became a time when there was absolutely no legal right to anything if you were a Protestant. If you didn't have Catholic baptism, you couldn't be married, you couldn't own land, you couldn't have any civil rights at all. You were given within the revocation, I think, a period of like 3 months in which either you would get baptized as a Catholic, you would give up your children out of the Christian schools to Catholic priests to teach them, that you would either leave and leave all your property behind, or as a Protestant minister, you would take on a new trade. They would train you and give you benefits for the rest of your life to become a lawyer. Now they're going to say, look, we'll make it easy. You preachers of the gospel, just give up your faith. You'll become a highly respected professional with more income than you've ever had. Very clever. You got to read the revocation. We'll share that with you along the way in the class. Very tantalizing. But at that time, there were some 3 or 4 million Huguenots, and in the course of a year or two, vast numbers of them emigrated. One of the reasons they say that Prussia became such a great power, as kind of a backwater part of Germany, is because so many Huguenots came with their Calvinistic faith and they revolutionized the country. Many of the settlers in America were Huguenots. La Rochelle became New Rochelle outside of New York. And much of that city was built with the brilliance of the Huguenot Calvinists with all of their skills. South Carolina, and it was populated largely by Huguenots. So it was a very powerful movement that spread all across Europe. But I came across when I was there an old book in French that was called Of the Clandestine Marriages of the Protestants. It was a treatise written about in 1735, an old book that I found. I was able to buy this thing. And what it was a Catholic arguing for the necessity of legalizing the marriages of Protestants because of the chaos it was creating. Now, this was some years after the Edict of Nantes had been revoked, and he is still saying, and there are still some 3 million Huguenots in this country. So, I mean, they were a huge number. What I think happened is that what was most deadly to the Huguenots was not persecution, but was actually when Napoleon came on the scene and gave them complete freedom. He gave them freedom that they'd never had. Napoleon's, as an enlightened humanist, was, let's let all religions be equal but have no state religion, per se. Let them each have their own tradition. And what happened is that Protestant Huguenot theology basically died through liberalism. It survived a whole century of persecution, immigration, but it couldn't survive liberalism. And today there's only a handful of a few Huguenot churches that are left that are committed to the Christian faith of the Gallican Confession. It's tragic. I know one of the few pastors, so they're by the name of Gerard Boss. Maybe when he's in town, maybe I can have him come and lecture to our class on that very theme, because he knows a lot about French Reformed history and is still a believer in the Confession of La Rochelle. I happen to have that here in French for any of you who are French students. You can read that. I'm learning French. I'm almost fluent in my reading now, and it's pretty exciting to get into. So I'm reading a lot of the material around it. But that's a great story. It's largely an unknown story. So one of the things I hope to do is to really give it an emphasis, because the French tradition was swallowed up by the others, but the brilliance of the French tradition is what's blessed a number of the other systems of thought, okay? Because they were forced out. And what they did is their Reformed theology found root and helped permeate other aspects of this. So I happen to serve on the board of the Huguenot Fellowship, so I have a lot of vested interest in keeping people aware of the great reformational tradition. Aix-en-Provence, where Bill Edgar taught, is probably the only Reformed theological institution in the world that uses French as its primary language that's still committed to historic Calvinism. It's tragic. Where once there were 3 million. I mean, that's a powerful movement at any time in history. And you go back that far, it was a very powerful movement. And they would have been followers of the Gallican Confession. Now, the reason that the Gallican Confession, I think, is very important is because shortly thereafter, we're going to have the Scots Confession, which we will not study in this class, which would be fun to study, but we won't because it's not continental. But that's the product of John Knox. And Knox's theology that is very important in the creation of what will become the Westminster Confession of Faith is deeply influenced by the Gallican Confession, which he was exposed to directly and indirectly through his time in Geneva and then ultimately through its coming to Scotland through just the exchange of ideas. And so he will be influenced very directly by the Gallican Confession. Okay? Now, remember now, with the Gallican Confession, we have the maturation of Calvin's theology. Okay, and Calvin may not be the direct author of it, but it is his theology that's at work. And it will spawn the Scots Confession. It will also spawn the Belgic Confession. 2 years after the Gallican, the Belgic Confession will come into being. And this particular work is very fascinating because it's very, very close to the Confession of La Rochelle, but it's not the same. There are differences. And the Belgic Confession continues to exist as a living confession in the Christian Reformed Church, and it's part of their three forms of unity. Okay, so if you've heard of the three forms of unity, in fact, I have here a work called The Ecumenical Creeds and Reformed Confessions that's put out by the Board of Publications of the Christian Reformed Church. And they have here the Ecumenical Creeds, the Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, and Athanasian Creed, which are also part of the Lutheran tradition. And then they come along with Reformed Confessions of the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession, which is what we're looking at, which is still their confessional witness. Okay, so it is a living confession to this day, where the Dutch churches will find themselves then under the rule of the Belgic Confession of the Calvinistic Witness. I think you'll also find that in Schaff. You'll find both the Gallican and Belgic, I think, in English translation, if I remember correctly. So they'll be in Schaff as well. Now, yes, Scott.
So, I'm unclear, 1559, La Rochelle. Mm-hmm. Does Calvin go there? I mean, is he actually there? Is he?
Calvin is not able to leave Geneva. He was such a marked man that the day he...
That's what I thought.
They would have killed him. They hated Calvin.
So he didn't actually physically contribute to any of the wording. It's an immature question.
Well, I cannot give you a complete answer to that. Let me put it this way. I was going to raise this a little bit later, but it's appropriate to do this. Let me see if I can put my finger on it. There is in this volume 2 of Calvin's works, his selected works, where tracts and treatises are listed, a confession that is written up in... let's see, this is now, I guess, a couple years after when it's published, but I think it was actually written before, I can't prove it, or about the time. It's called A Confession of Faith in the Names of the Reformed Churches of France, drawn up during the war for presentation to the emperor, princes, and states of Germany at the Diet of Frankfurt, but which could not reach them, the passes being closed. Now published for the advantages which may accrue from it, and even because necessity requires it. That's quite a title of a confession, yeah. Written up by Calvin, okay?
Memorized.
You got the title down? All right. It's a confession of faith in the name of the Reformed Churches of France. Now, the reason that this is important is for a whole host of reasons, is that, one, it comes directly from Calvin's hand. It never gets an official standing. But when you read the correspondence that surrounds it, it's very clear that Calvin was writing this consciously to keep Lutheranism out of France. It's a fascinating... In my article that I've given to you, I appeal indirectly to that. I hope, the Lord willing, someday to write a very thorough article on all the correspondence, because it's fascinating. It demonstrates a confession whose primary purpose was to keep another confession from finding rootage. Because you see what... At the Colloquy of Poissy, which was a high-level meeting of the Roman Catholic leaders of France, and Beza, who is representing the Swiss-French theology, that they attempted to say, we must bring the Augsburg Confession into France. Now, that sounded awfully good, didn't it? Because after all, the Augsburg Confession, that's where Protestantism started. So that they were saying is, now you believe, you've signed the Augsburg Confession, let's bring it in. But Calvin, at that point in history, understood it had been the occasion of incredible division and fighting.
Right.
Partially because Melanchthon had varied it, partially because now there was a Lutheran reaction to drive out the Variata, partially because there are all hosts of issues that Lutherans and Reformed were debating. And so Calvin knew that at that high-level meeting that he needed to create a confession that would be a good witness for the German part of the Reformed tradition that would reflect the French, and also could be used as a witness to keep any kind of a introduction of the Augsburg Confession as the official Protestant theology. So then there could be an occasion to discipline the Protestants of France with a Protestant confession and cause persecution, seemingly being very magnanimous all the while. So Calvin will write some 9 letters to all sorts of high-level people saying, we must keep the Augsburg Confession out of France. We must go to this high-level meeting in, what was it, Frankfurt here, wherever we are, the Diet of Frankfurt, and introduce a clear French confession. But it wasn't able to make it because the wars had closed the passes and they couldn't get there in time. So it's a fascinating issue of high-level diplomacy in a confessional age. We couldn't even imagine confessions being used in any place of theology of politics today. I mean, you wouldn't even talk about it. But back then it was critical because... Remember, there was that idea, eius regio, eius religio. Whose region, his religion. Whatever the king believed became the theology. So it was very careful. Can you get a king to embrace a confession? Because it can bring political freedoms. It could cause civil war. I mean, a lot was at stake. So you need to remember that Calvin was far more than a theologian. He was a political leader of the highest level, impacting millions of people's lives. Would they have freedom to live or not? They might die because of what was written on a piece of paper and what a king said about it. So it was very, very high level stakes. And we lose sight of how important the confessions were. Today, they express our heart or our mind, but they don't express our political liberties. Back then they did. Okay, now, so what I'm saying is that there was already confession being written. And I think one of the questions is how much of this will impact the confession of La Rochelle. That's an important question. Also before that was written in our book, we have what's called a brief confession of faith, which is much shorter. It's called a brief form of a confession of faith for the use of those who desires to have a compendium of the Christian religion always at hand. So this is a kind of a small confession that Calvin draws up for just spiritual use. And so that, again, is one of the, as I understand it, the antecedents that helped to create. So did Calvin sit down and write the Confession of La Rochelle? I don't think so. But it's very conscious that there were very carefully crafted forms of confession that were available for his student who put them together and that ultimately assigned. And of course, Calvin had very deep, direct interest and influence in what was going on at La Rochelle.
Okay. And did he ever actually sign?
Well, I don't think he could sign it because
he was now
a member of a free city called Geneva, he could not sign it in that sense. But there was a copy I think there were three original copies that were made of the Confession of La Rochelle. One was kept in La Rochelle, one was sent to Geneva, and I think a third one was sent to Paris, if I remember correctly, for the king to see.
I don't know what he did with that.
Well, I think it had a legal standing of sorts, so he probably kept it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't think he burned it.
At this point, La Rochelle was a free city.
It was a free city.
It was not under attack.
That's right. In fact, the iconography of the tower that guards the harbor at La Rochelle is interesting. In an octagonal room that was the leading, I don't remember if he's called the captain of the tower. There was some title that was given to him. It was a one-year appointment that the king of France gave to him. He was not allowed to leave. He had to stay there for the whole year. And his responsibility was to make sure that the harbor was closed at night by a big chain, you know, to keep pirates out and so that attacks couldn't come in, and to monitor the traffic coming and going, and to protect the harbor if there was to be an attack. You got to remember that here, if you think of England here, the Netherlands here, and France down here on the coast, this is a free city where a lot of business of illegal stuff could happen. You know, as a port, so it was a very important port of call. And the iconography, when you go in this room, is interesting. There is a donkey and a lion that are face to face, and are in different postures. And obviously, the France symbol of the king as a lion is very well understood. The donkey represents England. You know, they're ancient enemies. That's right. That's right. And so you have the lion facing the donkey face to face, reminding him all the time. Now remember, you're neither. You're not a lion, you're not a donkey, but you represent both interests. We need each other. We need to have this free exchange. But remember, a donkey and a lion don't get along. They're natural enemies. And so there's one posture where they also are facing each other, but their necks are intertwined. They have one complete wrap, and they're still facing each other. That reminds them, the captain, this is his dwelling place, this is his home, that he not only recognizes that they're enemy, but when he looks over at this iconographical representation, that while they're enemies, they have to do business together. They got to figure out a way to get intertwined without ever connecting, still being face to face, eyeball to eyeball, not on the same team, but yet together. It's a fascinating picture. And then on a couple other places, it has the face of the ancient classical symbol of the fool who happens to be smiling. And then another one with the frowning face to remind you that if you don't play the fool, men will be happy. If you play the fool, you're going to cause tremendous heartache for many, many people. See, because he had a political, military, but neutral position to play. It was a free city. And of course, one of the great studies that has been done is, why is it that the gospel took hold in different parts of Europe? And one of the great points is that wherever free cities were, the Reformation took very deep hold. Because when there is freedom, there's also this idea of the freedom of inquiry. And what happened is that the Protestant reformational ideas took very deep root, so that 80% of the city at one point is in fact Huguenot, French Calvinistic. Okay, so it's an important place, and you can see later why Richelieu will come and just totally... Now this is an interesting story. When Richelieu surrounded La Rochelle, burned everything in between it, put a dike out into the sea, put up the barriers, had a whole armada out there so that the Dutch or the English could not come to the rescue of the Huguenots. Nobody could get through. He understood how pivotal a city this was that he had to destroy. Early 1600s. It was before the it was under the Edict of Nantes, I think, but for whatever reason, they wanted to destroy the city because of its influence, because of its Calvinistic impact on the nation. And I got to get my, I'll have them right when I get to the lecture, but what is fascinating is that there were some 18,000 inhabitants that were barred up in the city. They resisted all political, I mean military attack, all political intrigue. After about a year, I think there were some 5,000 people left. They died of starvation. They saw 13,000 people die in that city. And during the times, they always were loyal to the king. They actually, as I understand, if it wasn't during Richelieu's siege in an earlier siege, they actually sent a letter to the king requesting the permission as they casted their cannons to put the royal insignia of loyalty on their cannon to the king. You see, the king had sent these very soldiers to destroy La Rochelle. And their view was is that we are not resisting the king. We are simply defending ourselves for the right to live and the right to freedom. But we are loyal to the king. We would ask for even our cannons aimed at the king's soldiers to have the king's insignia. So what kind of double think is that? But that's the age that they were in. Absolutely loyal to the crown. But simply saying, we're not fighting an offensive war. We have no desire to uproot the king's rightful authority. But there's an unjust assault against us. We're simply defending our right to be under legal standing. And we want to show that by having our cannons cast with the royal insignia. A different age than we live in, right?
Is that when La Rochelle ceased to be a free city after everybody's wiped out? Where did it
I think it will continue to be a free city thereafter, but there's not going to be the freedom to practice the Huguenot religion.
Well, is it a free city today still?
No, it's part of France. Okay. See, history, after the Napoleonic Wars, many things changed.
Right, okay, so it's somewhere there actually till the 19th century.
I can't tell you the exact day when La Rochelle became officially a part of France, but there are no free imperial cities left in France today. At some point,
about
Monaco? I was going to say there might be a couple small national representation, like maybe Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, maybe Monaco, but very small. But all across Europe, by and large, most of those after the vicissitudes of the modern nation state got swallowed up whole. And I can't tell you the history of each of them. And I'll try to find out La Rochelle when it ceases to be an independent state. My thinking is that it probably occurred probably sometime after Richelieu's destruction and Napoleonic War. Somewhere in there it ceases to be an independent free state. All right, at any rate, let's finish up. We only have a little bit of time left since we took a late break. But... what we were trying to do is to understand the emergence of the Reformed confessions. We were gotten down to the Belgic and Scots confession, and we noted that they both are offshoots of the Gallican. We were talking about Calvin's role in developing the Gallican confession. Now, another interesting thing to keep in mind is that emerging from the Gallican tradition is going to be what we'll call the Heidelberg Catechism. And we can see that from different strains. Obviously, it's going to come out on the first from the Variata. It is very directly a Lutheran crypto-Calvinistic rootage, very consciously in a Germanic land, and the ability to operate under the Variata was very important in Heidelberg. I think that area is called the Palatinate, and that area is under the whole struggle of Lutheran and Calvinistic. And with the Variata, they had room to breathe. And you can read about that in my article. That's something that we'll talk a little bit about there. Now, as you note, if you come down back in the Lutheran line, shortly thereafter in 1580 is when it's the Book of Concord. It's really 1577 when the Formula of Concord is written. It's just a few years thereafter that they write their classic statement of Lutheran orthodoxy, and that is very consciously to root out crypto-Calvinism, because the Heidelberg Catechism had made it very easy to have a reformational reform teaching tool that was not distinctively Lutheran, yet operating under the Augsburg Confession because of the Variatus. So they had to come up with a very powerful tool. They're going to be Lutheran and not Reformed, and that's what the Formula of Concord was designed to address.
Concord was actually responding specifically to Heidelberg, not responding to, but because of?
Well, let's say because of the Calvinistic issues, and in the area where the Heidelberg was, there was so much Calvinistic presence that they wanted to get rid of it. They didn't want this Calvinism emerging. You see, in that era, the notion of having more than one confession in one place was just unthinkable. They had to compromise and say, all right, there's going to be Lutheran here and there's going to be Catholic here, but they hoped to stop there. The Lutherans didn't want to give anybody any freedom. And when the Reformed got their chance, they were not sure they wanted anybody else. They didn't want Lutherans present. The modern experience that we enjoy of plural confessions in a common area was unthinkable at that era, you know. And so confessions were designed very much to draw lines, to keep people away in political as well as theological senses. They still function that way theologically, but they don't function that way politically anymore in most areas of the world where Christianity goes. Now, be that as it may, what we need to see then is that Calvin's theology then is having a tremendous impact in this stream. So there's a point where the Bullingerian theology becomes lesser significant. It's still present. It's impacted Calvin very much. But now Calvin's theology is emanating through these different versions as it begins to take place. And in that context, there is one confession. I don't remember if I have it in that one handout that we use. Since this is handy, do I mention it? I do know that another document comes up after the Formula of Concord. It's called the Saxon Visitation Articles in 1592. Not intended to supersede, but there's another document that has significance in the tradition. It's not being amended, but in a sense, there's another authority that's coming alongside. And later Lutherans have clearly jettisoned much of it. And when I studied at the Lutheran Seminary at Mount Airy here, they made it clear it's just the Augsburg Confession that they follow. They said, these others are important, but we're not obliged to those. Which is interesting because, you know, the Pope is not condemned in the Augsburg Confession. It's a very interesting tool for ecumenicity in the modern world. And also its view of Scripture may not be as precise that it would prohibit higher criticism and other things. There's some interesting reasons to say, well, this is our view. Plus it is very Lutheran in the Lord's Supper, however. So you see, it's a fascinating point.
Which makes it more acceptable also against the Roman Catholics.
So it's an interesting decision, at least it used to be the LCA, now it's the ELCA, because the two more liberal denominations have merged. I would say that the Missouri Lutheran, obviously, to hold to the Formula of Concord is to hold to the Augsburg Confession, not only in its view of the Supper, but in its rooting out people who don't hold to it. I mean, you know, its whole intention was to say, there is no crypto-Calvinism allowed here. Out. Okay. So it's a stricter view, and Lutheranism, as I say, has continued to define itself very much by the Augsburg Confession, but the Formula of Concord is not necessarily in place. Now, has it been added to or amended to? I'd have to ask the question, then what authority did the Saxon Visitation Articles have? Because that you'll find that in Schaff, Volume 3, too. I think it's in there. And that is an English translation as well.
Now, would that be included in
No, it's after the Book of Concord.
Not, okay, so it's not.
It's not amending that, but it does have some authority in the Lutheran tradition. So what's going on? And I'm very confident that if you went to Germany today to a Lutheran church, there would almost be no church there that I know of that's a state church that would be committed to the theology of the Formula of Concord. But they may still want to be Lutheran, and they're probably doing it much out of that Augsburg. So what if they have? At some point, they've broken the authority of that document and have kept part of it. Okay, so. all right, now as you go along here, you get to the Heidelberg Catechism then. And again, that's available in a number of sources. Volume 3 of Schaff, it's available in that volume of the Ecumenical Councils done by the CRC, so you can find that. That'll have it there too. And that's a great jewel. It's a spiritual gem, well designed to deal with a catechumen, not as a theological student, but as a one who's in love with Christ. Touches his heart. It has a beauty. And I love the Westminster Shorter Catechism, but there's something that breathes a pastoral love that's unique about the Heidelberg. It's good to see these differences that you might look at, okay? The Heidelberg Catechism is very clearly a Calvinistic statement done in a German land, developing under the aegis and hegemony of the Augsburg Confession as varied, and that's in my article referred to some of that. Okay, now one of the things we didn't address, but we should do it quickly, is next to Calvin back here in the Genevan Catechism, there is another thing that Calvin wrote that gained some creedal status, but only in Geneva. And that's this work called Concerning the Eternal Predestination of God. It's translated by J.K.S. Reed. It's probably one of the great documents where the theology of Calvin's sovereign grace is developed against those who opposed it in his lifetime. So you get names like Pigius and Georgius and Bolzec, I think, are at least three of the names that were conscious opponents of Calvin's theology that he interacts with. This was written as a private document. It was sent to the magistrates, it was approved, and it became the official theological statement of Geneva on the matter of predestination. So it is actually a creed. It does not find its standing in the Schaff's Creeds of Christendom. Schaff says, because of its localized force only in Geneva, because of its length, over 100 pages, and its focus on one topic, he does not include it. Okay, so he made an editorial decision. He does not include the Consensus Tigurinus either. That was not included, but Hodge had that, we mentioned.
Is there a reason for that?
Because of their localized character and other
the
things.
Same reason?
Maybe he includes it and he doesn't translate it. I don't remember the exact answer. There are a few things. He doesn't include the Tetrapolitan Confession, I remember, he says, because it's of limited and no longer used by anyone. I think he doesn't include this because of its length, and I think I'm correct. I could be mistaken, but at any rate, the point is that this is available in this form.
Is it still confessed, do you think?
I don't know. This was by James Clark and Company.
J.K.S.
Reed, R-E-I-D. Okay, our time is almost up, so let me hasten to add just a few quick final thoughts. Dord comes on the scene to address Arminius, the Arminian articles, and the canons of the Council of Dort are available in English in the sense that the English version is present in Schaff. Dort is present only in the Dutch and Latin, I think, in Schaff. You can get the English, though, in this particular version that I have here from the CRC, that handbook. So there are English translations available. Yes?
I think it's also included in Mark Null.
I'm sure there might be many sources where it's available, but many times they'll be included without the negations. There are the rejections of error section. So make sure if you get an English translation, it's not just the positive statement, but also the rejection of errors, because that's part of it from a confessional viewpoint. Okay, so really with that point, the Reformed tradition is fully defined in its different parts. You notice that all the Reformed community comes together to address in different ways the Arminian theology. Now there's one last confession that I think I appeal to in your notes, which is called the Formula Consensus Helvetica, 1675, I think is the date. It's in the Reformed Orthodox era, just before the Enlightenment period is going to take off. And it also is a very localized confession written by a man named Heidegger, who would have been under the influence of, I think, Turretin's theology. The classic, that whole era of high Reformed Orthodoxy is at work there. And that particular confession is especially designed to refute Amiraux's theology. Remember, Amiraux is the French Reformed theologian of Saumur who develops the four-point Calvinism. You spell it A-M-Y-R-A-U-L-D, Amiraux. And it's called sublapsarianism in systematics. And it's the idea of a hypothetical universalism, that Christ died for everyone, hypothetically. not redemptively, but so that you can say Christ did die for you, even though you may not be one of the elect. Okay, so it's kind of an inconsistent Calvinism. It also has some interesting ideas in terms of the nature of the covenant of grace and other things that Amiro developed. Yes?
Is this to refute Amiro, or is this...
To refute Amiro. That's part of its purpose. You can find that also as the second appendix in this work by Hodge. Okay, The Outlines of Theology by A.A. Hodge. In English translation, you'll find it as the Formula Consensus Helvetica. One of the interesting things that it does mention is that it argues that the power of the points are inspired. In the Hebrew vowel points, remember the Masoretic text, adds the vowel points that are not part of the ancient documents. This particular confession is dealing with biblical theology and inspiration, and it argues for that. So that's what it's famous for. It had localized force. It lasted for about 50 years in authority and then kind of fell to the ongoing advances of Enlightenment thought. Okay, so that about ties up the documents that are part of the Continental Reformation era. There are a lot of stuff. And isn't it amazing that you can't get any of this all in one place? So in God's providence, maybe someday, I hope, or maybe with students' help, we'll put together some kind of collection of all these Reformed documents in one place in English translation. I don't think you can find it. It's amazing. But yet it's understandable. When you think of the flow of theology, is that theology has lost its force for the modern world. In its liberal forms, they have no interest in confessions. And in the modern form of theology, Latin and languages that were theological languages are no longer learned. So we're facing a breach here, and someone needs to bring the gap back. So that's why one of the reasons I'm trying to give you that idea of a project. If you can find something untranslated, we need to get it done, because we should love our history enough that we want to get it out to others who are going to at least do accurate research. So a great project would be to put together in one place all of these creeds and confessions and good English translation with biblical reference for home use and scholarly use. There's no reason we couldn't do that. Continental confessions have a huge impact on the Westminster Assembly. As you can see, where does the Westminster come? It comes at the very end of the confessional era, which means that everything written in the Reformed tradition before it, one way or another, may have an impact on the shaping of its language and its perspective. And that's important to realize. So one great area for future reflection is, how does the Westminster engage directly, indirectly, the prior Reformed tradition? What issues is it silent upon that were developed elsewhere? What issues does it balance that may recognize differences? So it's a fascinating question. Okay. All right, our time is basically up, so we'll be together next week. And I think I've introduced you to all the books that are relevant for this class. As I said, I have no one textbook, but you need to use a lot of different books. For next class, I've given your assignment of trying to read the 67 articles of Zwingli, the 10 Theses of Barron, and the Augsburg Confession, and the article that I've distributed. Try to review that chart and get all that stuff more or less in your mind so you can have a kind of a historical flow. Any final questions before we dismiss? Yes?
I guess there are some things in the Book of Concord that are not going to be in Schaff. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So is this something that's worth having?
Oh, if you care about Lutheran theology, then you have to have Tappert. It's absolutely essential. It's the best English translation, and it brings together the authoritative documents of the Lutheran Reformation in one place. I think Schaff only has the Luther's Shorter Catechism and the Augsburg Confession and the Formula of Concord. So all that other stuff, like the Apology, the Schmalkaldic articles, I think it will represent the Variata and Invariata as a footnote. I think it does. I need to double check. But because it's really only one article with a brief, by taking out one line, it changes a lot of theology. Okay?
Of course, I guess this isn't going to have the Variata either.
I think it will represent that too as a footnote. And if I remember correctly, it will list it. But it will tell you what's the authoritative version.
Right.
Now, if you're not in my Lutheran Orthodoxy class, if you're looking for a good historical background, probably the best in one place for all the background of the Book of Concord is by Benta, Historical Introductions to the Book of Concord. The reason I say this is best is not because necessarily it is the best treatment, but it's the most expansive in short order. He touches all the great debates of the formula of Concord, which I can't talk about in this class, but if you're in my other class, we'll talk about that in just an hour, what's in the formula of Concord. Okay.